Every piece of this is man's bullshit. They call this war a cloud over the land, but they made the weather, and then they stand in the rain and say, shit, it's raining!
I did what I did for the good of the realm. The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agree to tell each other over and over. Till we forget that it's a lie. But what do we have left once we abandon the lie? Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. Many who try to climb it fail, but never get to try again.
Well, here we go. It's Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in north central Indiana, where it's a beautiful day here in Indiana, but it's supposed to rain this afternoon and maybe snow. If it does, it'd be the first snow of the season. How about that? We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46580. Or 8-1, I'm sorry. That's where you send your do-re-mi, boys and girls, so we can pay a few bills around here. Yeah, and it's Freya's Day, and let's find a song here that's appropriate for the she-wolves.
Well, you think you got trouble? Man, listen to me. Tell you a story as it happened, you see. I got four little kids waiting at home. My wife done packed her trunk and gone. She done moved on across the tracks, and I know that gal ain't coming back. I got trouble. I got troubles on my mind. Well, I got troubles. Hey, those lonesome kind. Well, every morning by the 8 o'clock, the kids start crying and holler pop. Where's my mama? Where's she gone? And when's my mama gonna come back home? I got trouble. I got troubles on my mind. Well, I got troubles. Hey, those lonesome kind. Well, my little girl is only 3. I picked her up and set her on my knee. Tried to soothe her crying, but she cries too hard. And the crying old daddy, well, oh Lord. I got troubles on my mind. Well, I got troubles, hey, those lonesome kind. Woo! The floor. I got troubles. I got troubles on my mind. Well, I got troubles. Hey, those lonesome kind. Well, I told you a story as it happened to me, just the way that it happened, you see. You got a good gal, don't you do no wrong. She'll pack her trunk and then be gone. You'll have troubles. You'll have troubles on your mind. Hey,
well, that's Hillbilly Pilgrim there with a jumpy jivey song that you should be able to dance across the kitchen floor with. How about that? His baby's gone, she went across the tracks. All the little kids say, when's mama coming back? I'm digging something out here to run for you. It's an in-depth study of our boy from the Breitbart News, Steve Bannon, who hates racists, hates anti-Jew boys. And so I'm going to give you the full background on this guy. And thanks to something I recorded last night in the middle of the night. So let's see if I can find it. I can guarantee you one thing. He's no racial separatist. He is not a racial separatist. Or he wouldn't be in this position he's in right now.
Send the pic. The center has called Breitbart News a white ethno-nationalist propaganda mill. Bannon has described Breitbart News as a platform for the alt-right, but he disputes the charge that he or the website embraces racism or anti-Semitism. To learn more about Bannon, we're going to hear from Joshua Green of Bloomberg Businessweek, who wrote a lengthy profile of him last year before Bannon joined the Trump campaign. Green is the magazine's senior national correspondent and a weekly columnist for the Boston Globe. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Joshua Green, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start at the beginning. Tell us about Steve Bannon. Where did he grow up? What was his background like?
Well, Bannon grew up in a blue-collar Irish Catholic family outside a naval base near Richmond, Virginia. And after college, he joined the Navy. This is in the late 70s. Wound up with a job in the Pentagon, got a master's degree in Georgetown. And he became captivated, I think, by what he saw going on Wall Street. This was the 80s. It was Ronald Reagan. Being an investment banker seemed like an adventure. He said that friends who were in the field told him, you know, if you really want to be a good investment banker, you need to go to Harvard Business School. And so he applied, got in, and that was the path that he took.
Got out, started working at Goldman Sachs. What did he do? What did he specialize in?
Well, basically, the way Bannon described it to me is he had to talk himself into a job at Goldman Sachs. But he wound up specializing in mergers and acquisitions, and this is at a time when Wall Street was changing, and banks like Goldman recognized that there was going to be a premium on specialization. And so Bannon decided to specialize in media and shipped out to Goldman's Los Angeles office and basically wound up as a deal maker, making deals between movie studios and TV companies. After a few years of doing that, he and a partner ventured off on their own, and Bannon started a boutique investment bank that got further invested in setting up deals between people like Ted Turner and Castle Rock Pictures and negotiating different fees and different deals and becoming very wealthy along the way.
Some of his money comes from Seinfeld royalties, is this right?
This is true, yes. I mean, he told me that one of his most memorable deals was between Ted Turner and Castle Rock Pictures, which I believe owned the rights to the Seinfeld show, which at the time was only in like its first or its second season and was far from a hit. Turner wound up a bit short of cash when it came time to come to the table, and rather than let the deal fall apart, Bannon agreed to take residual from a basket of TV shows that included Seinfeld in lieu of his full fee. And the way he described it to me, he said that Seinfeld was the runt of the litter, that there were other shows that were more popular and seemed like they would pay off more down the line. But as we all know now, Seinfeld became an enormous hit. And so he's had a steady stream of income from that ever since.
Because he was in the entertainment end of the financial industry, he ended up making movies. He made a documentary, I guess, about Reagan called In the Face of Evil. This was around the time he connected with Andrew Breitbart. Tell us who he was and how they got together.
Well, Andrew Breitbart was a conservative provocateur, I guess is the best way to put it. But he's someone who lived out in Hollywood. He worked for Matt Drudge, who runs the Drudge Report website. So he's someone who has a deep, deep understanding of kind of how the culture processes political news and how to shape news narratives by focusing people's attention on certain stories or certain storylines. Breitbart was an interesting guy because he lived and circulated in Hollywood, which, as we know, tends to be a bastion of liberalism. But here he was, a conservative, rubbing elbows with people like Arianna Huffington, a lot of other folks. Breitbart delighted in kind of, provoking and outraging those liberals, really derived a lot of joy, I think, from being the skunk at the garden party. Bannon himself was living out in L.A. at the time, had become really smitten with Ronald Reagan after his time in the Navy. He read a book by a conservative author named Peter Schweitzer called Reagan's War, and decided, you know, he had the money, he thought he understood the entertainment industry, and he made a documentary called Reagan's War about Schweitzer's book. And it was at the premiere of that movie in 2004, Bannon describes it, that Breitbart essentially came storming out of the audience and gave him a big bear hug in a speech about how guys like them had to take back the culture. And basically Breitbart, I think, conscripted Bannon into what was then it was pre-Tea Party, but it was that kind of Republican populist view that we have to kind of rise up and take back our government and take back our culture. And Bannon obviously heard a lot in that he liked. And so he wound up becoming a financial backer and then ultimately the executive chairman of Breitbart News after Andrew Breitbart died.
I had forgotten this, but it was Breitbart News that broke the Anthony Weiner texting scandal originally.
It was, yes. And that was a classic Breitbart kind of story, in that it took someone who was a liberal culture warrior all over TV, you know, loudly condemning Republicans, and essentially exposed him as a hypocrite in the most embarrassing and humiliating sort of way. And if you remember back to that scandal, you know, initially Weiner denied it, and then he said he'd been hacked. And then there was just this bizarre, surreal scene where Weiner was getting ready to have a press conference, and all of the New York media had assembled around this empty podium. And then out from backstage comes not Anthony Weiner, but Andrew Breitbart himself, who hijacked the press conference and the microphone and began taking questions from astonished reporters. That was a classic Breitbart kind of move, just creating a media firestorm and then kind of gleefully egging it on. And ultimately, you know, that took down Anthony Weiner.
Andrew Breitbart died in 2012 suddenly, and Bannon became executive chairman of Breitbart News. Was his approach any different from Andrew Breitbart?
The way that Bannon describes it, there is a clear continuation from Matt Drudge to Andrew Breitbart to Breitbart News as it exists under Bannon and Larry Solov, who is the CEO. What Bannon told me, I went back and pulled some notes from my interview at the time. He said, Breitbart is almost like a medieval guild where you're passing on that special knowledge. You know, we learned it from Andrew, who learned it from Drudge. We are going to carry on the banner and keep doing what Andrew wanted us to do. So that is sort of the view or the conceit that folks at Breitbart News have, this idea that they're kind of carrying on Breitbart's war against the culture. And that's very much what Bannon seemed to think he was doing over the last few years.
In 2012, when Steve Bannon was the executive editor of Breitbart, he established a research arm, the Government Accountability Institute. What does it do?
Well, Bannon, what attracted me to Bannon originally was that, you know, if you look at kind of the infrastructure, the organizational chart of the Republican right wing, what Hillary Clinton once referred to as the vast right wing conspiracy, what you see is that a lot of the tendrils lead back to Steve Bannon. So not only was Bannon executive chairman of Breitbart News, but then with some of the same financial backers, he started the Government Accountability Institute, which is a nonprofit research organization based in Tallahassee. And whereas Breitbart is gleefully provocative and hard right, the conceit at GAI is that this is a research organization that is going to do digging and stick to the realm of facts, and they're going to investigate corruption and cronyism in government, be it Republican or Democrat. GAI was a pretty sleepy shop, but what really brought GAI into the forefront was that GAI's president, Peter Schweitzer, wrote the book Clinton Cash that became an unexpected bestseller back in the spring of 2015, just as Hillary Clinton was getting ready to launch her presidential campaign. It drove up her unfavorability ratings, and it raised all sorts of pernicious questions about who Clinton and the Clinton Foundation had financial relationships with, and whether or not this was going to be a problem in her presidential campaign. It was clear, I think, from the scope and tenor of the coverage that there was really something there. And that is the other way, I think, in which Bannon has been able to hack mainstream media news coverage, because these Clinton cash stories and the various relationships that the book documented were intentionally not published on right-wing sites like Breitbart News. What GAI did instead was to reach out to investigative reporters in mainstream media outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others, and try and encourage their reporters to take this research that they'd done and to go off and do some digging on their own. And they did, and that wound up resulting in front page stories in a lot of major newspapers that got this negative information about Clinton in front of a whole different audience than reads Breitbart News or listens to talk radio. And if you look at how Donald Trump chose to run against Clinton in the general election, Trump was essentially channeling the same attacks that Bannon had conceived and pushed in the Clinton cash book. And so ultimately, you know, he succeeded in this years-long plan to plot and carry off the downfall of Hillary Clinton.
Joshua Green is senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Business Week. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with Joshua Green. He is senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Business Week. We're talking about Steve Bannon, who has been named to a senior post by President-elect Donald Trump. You know, there's a lot of consternation, criticism, alarm about the appointment of Bannon to a senior-level position in the Trump White House. The concern is that it suggests a tolerance, if not embrace, of racism and anti-Semitism. What about the idea that Breitbart News itself propagates, you know, white supremacist views? I mean, the New York Times editorial on this said, to scroll through Breitbart's headlines is to come upon a parallel universe where black people do nothing but commit crimes, immigrants rape native-born daughters, and feminists want to castrate men. Southern Poverty Law Center says he made Breitbart News a white ethno-nationalist propaganda mill. What's your sense of the content of Breitbart News?
Well, it is certainly inflammatory and fixated on race, on religion, on all the sorts of things that have upset people. I think the thing to understand about Breitbart, and this is not to excuse anything they write or publish, is that they are deliberately provocative. They're aiming to offend and upset people in order to stoke the grassroots anger at government and the broader culture. In internet language, it's an elaborate and effective trolling operation. Because that is what marshals this group of disaffected Republicans, you know, and other people, sometimes referred to as the alt-right, but essentially this splinter faction of conservatives who have attacked and now taken over the Republican Party over the last 4 or 5 years.
You know, it's one thing if white supremacists read Breitbart News and if they write shocking comments in response to the stories, but as you look at the content, I mean, does the website seem to, you know, embrace and propagate these views of white nationalism and white supremacists? What's your story?
I think it certainly fuels those views. And, you know, I had a discussion with Bannon about this back in 2015, about, you know, I said, you know, you're a former Harvard guy, you're a Goldman Sachs banker. I'm sort of shocked at some of the things you write because you come out of a culture that isn't, you know, openly racist or anti-Semitic. And what he said essentially was that they are trying to reach an audience that doesn't have an outlet anywhere else in mainstream media. I pulled up some of the quotes. He said, you know, we focus on things like immigration, ISIS, race riots, what he calls the persecution of Christians. He says, we give a perspective that other outlets are not going to give. There are not a lot of outlets that are covering that, at least not from the perspective that we should be running a victory lap every time some sort of traditional value gets undercut. the question I was always interested in getting at with Bannon was, do you really believe this stuff? Because a lot of it is offensive and inflammatory. And he said, you know, personally, I'm mixed on a lot of this stuff, but we're airing a lot of things that traditional people are thinking that don't get mainstream media representation anymore. So they were making a market for these kinds of views and these kinds of stories and attracting an audience, what's turned out to be an extremely large and powerful audience, by tapping these sentiments.
I'm wondering what Bannon brought to the campaign. It seems like his real expertise is in messaging. Was he primarily a guy who brought that expertise?
I think messaging and theater, for lack of a better word. I mean, Bannon is a guy who came out of the media world. He used to be a movie producer. He made documentary movies. He's somebody, I think, with a pretty clear sense of narrative and also of the value of presentation and how you can seize the attention of the entire political culture if you push the buttons right. I think he's figured out that you can essentially seize control of the political conversation through stunts like the one that Bannon orchestrated before the second debate, where he rolled out all these women who had accused Bill Clinton of sexual assault and sexual harassment. And he's somebody, I think, who takes Trump's impulses and channels them into a more or less cogent worldview that fits into this right-wing populist ethos that Bannon is all about.
You know, what's interesting about it is that if Bannon was good at pushing Trump in directions of appealing to this provocative populist message, it's in the closing days of the campaign, when Trump was muted and on message and not making headlines, that he really made progress in the polls. It's kind of an irony, isn't it?
No, I actually wouldn't agree with that. I think in the closing days of the campaign, if you listen to what Trump was saying, I mean, it was unhinged. I mean, this stuff about dark conspiracy theories and cabals of global bankers, it struck tones, I think, that were anti-Semitic. I would argue that Trump, in the final weeks of the campaign, was mainlining the purest distillation of Bannon's views out there on the stump, and that, to my shock and a lot of other people's, that actually resonated with a much larger segment of the electorate than we had anticipated.
He's an interesting character, and, you know, in your profile of him, the photos show him wearing cutoffs. And when you see him in photos now, like with the transition team, he really stands out from the Trump family, who are so carefully, you know, tailored and coiffed. I mean, Bannon, you know, he looks a little unkempt. He might have a little growth of beard. He doesn't have a tie. His hair isn't exactly combed. I mean, you know, if one were being unkind, you might say he looks like somebody ready to mix it up. You spent time with him. Is this a cultivated look, or is that just him?
That is just, I mean, if you want to be blunt, he looks like a bloated, homeless alcoholic and revels in that view. I mean, if you look at the cover picture he let us shoot for Business Week, he is sitting on a couch wearing, like, two polo shirts on top of each other with an Oxford shirt over that and cargo shorts and flip-flops, clearly hasn't shaved or showered. He revels in this image of himself as an outsider who is giving a big middle finger to the system.
There are petitions circulating urging Trump to reverse the hiring of Steve Bannon. Why is he so loyal to Steve Bannon?
There's been so much kind of shock and consternation about how a guy like Bannon, who is so far outside the bounds of anybody who typically be considered for a West Wing position, gets elevated to one. I think it's important to remember what we've just witnessed and what Trump himself has just seen. That Bannon, and this is what originally attracted me to him as a profile subject, is a smart guy and a clever strategist who orchestrated this elaborate plan to deny Hillary Clinton the presidency that we've just watched work. It succeeded. And so I think that Trump has a degree of faith in Bannon that he doesn't have in other people. And I think that's why Trump has been willing to withstand all the intense criticism over the Bannon appointment that we've seen the last few days. To me, it's sort of like the least shocking aspect of what Trump has done in appointing Bannon to the West Wing. I mean, the guy hatched this elaborate plan to stop Clinton, and it worked.
The plan being to research her background as a Senate State Department and put out the book and feed it to the mainstream media.
Yeah, well, the plan being, you know, this multi-year, multifaceted effort to take down Hillary Clinton, right? Part of it was Breitbart News with its rolling narratives about how Clinton was corrupt and doing Benghazi and this and that, and really stoking all this conservative right-wing anger against her and against any Republican that treated her as anything less than, you know, a terrible pariah and a threat to the country. That eventually came to include people like Paul Ryan, who are the most mainstream of Republicans. And then on the other hand, you have the Government Accountability Institute and the Clinton Cash book that figured out a way to kind of hack into the mainstream media and propagate these negative anti-Clinton stories that had the effect of driving up her unfavorability ratings. If you look at what happened in the election, essentially Clinton was too unpopular to reconstitute the Obama coalition that got him elected twice. She lost the presidential race narrowly. I mean, to my mind, Bannon is one of the major figures, if not the major figure, that conceived of and orchestrated and carried out that attack. That was what he laid out in the piece that I thought was so interesting. And to be honest, I never thought in a million years he would carry it off. But look, he has.
Joshua Green, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was great being with you.
Joshua Green.
Secure area to you.
Well, that was interesting, right? At least I thought so. Gives you a lot of information. Yes, it came from the left, but the left, they don't always lie, and the right doesn't always tell the truth. In fact, certain people on both sides lie, whether the right or left or in the middle. Now, Bannon reminds me of E. Wendell House, that was a shadow guy in the Wilson cabinet back around World War I. And he also reminds me of Harry Dexter White, the Marxist who lived in the White House during the Roosevelt administrations. And there's a lot of people with power, a lot of times they'll sneak in these guys. Now look, did you see Henry Kissinger is now playing around with Trump? Well, of course, the minute Henry Kissinger gets in the picture, if you're not gone by then, I don't know what to tell you. I will talk about these people, but that's about it. I'll give you facts about these people, but as far as any kind of support, and like in the beginning of the campaign, the primary, I said that Trump was a shill. I was shocked when he won, like everybody else, but now I begin to see the picture developing. Either they after the fact, they brought circled the wagons or not. It's going to end up the same way. We're still going to be in wars all over the place. The infrastructure, I doubt whether it's rebuilt very much. We'll still be borrowing tremendous amounts of money from China. And probably flirting with military activities against North Korea, which is a ridiculous joke. Now, you remember how we got into the Vietnam War. You know, it was nothing much going on there until President Johnson, put together this Tonkin Bay thing where supposedly the Vietnamese fired on American ships, which we found out after about 50,000 guys died in Vietnam, that never happened. So this is a problem. You can't trust any of these guys. I keep telling you that, and I know that some of you believe me, some of you don't. But you can't trust them. They're going for power. This Breitbart thing, they're trying to do like the Southern Strategy, where the Republican Party grabbed a hold of the whites in the South and built that into a powerhouse. And almost all of them would deny ever being a racist at all. And probably they're not, because they're more interested in power and money than they are race. They have no loyalty to the race at all in reality. So when I'm giving you information, all these people and so forth and so on, it's not because I'm supporting any of them. But I will point out information. You can use it the way you want and spread it among your friends if you want. But I would say two-thirds of the white public don't know what you're talking about. Whenever I talk to somebody in the white public and I get the least bit below the surface with information, their eyes glaze over and the lights are on, but nobody's home. So I pretty much gave that up. I think the only way a sizable percentage of the white race is going to start thinking race again is when there is a collapse, a financial collapse, or we're actually attacked by some foreign country or something like that. But not until. They're perfectly happy with their myths that they cling on to, whether it's religion or what. Anyhow, anyone that gets to the power of presidency is, they've always got at least one key guy. Yeah, one. Maybe more, but usually one. Rasputin, like the Tsar had. Don't get me wrong, Trump or anybody else, or Hillary, they can throw you a bone that'll make you happy. Even Obama threw a few bones that that I agreed with. But in retrospect, everything else was crap. It was garbage. It was slop. And people bought into it. You can sell stuff, anything, to anybody if you sugarcoat it right. And that's what they do, and they get everybody excited. Now we're going to really change things, but you'll find after about 4 years they haven't really changed much at all, except for things to get worse for the white race. I see Duke's got visions of grandeur again. He thinks he's going to get up there finally, and he's gonna, allegedly somebody said he's going to start a 24-hour radio network. I guess he's trying to copy the Breitbart operation. Well, I see the Catholic Church, or at least, the Protestants in Germany, officially renounced converting Jews to Christianity. Evidently, they said that's anti-Semitic. That Christians see Jesus as their Savior and Jews don't is a fact that we leave up to God, reads the resolution adopted by the Evangelical Church in Germany. They don't want to offend the Jews by saying they're trying to switch them over to Jesus. But that sort of flies in the face of what it says in the latter days, when their mythical Jesus is supposed to come back and the Jews don't bend their knee to Jesus. Jesus' forces are going to kill them all. So Adolf Hitler's ideas come true. Well, this come out of Washington. A pair of high-profile senators are making a bipartisan push to try and curb growing anti-Judaism in Europe at a time when such fears have spiked in the U.S. following Donald Trump's election. Florida Senator Marco Rubio and Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, Hillary's running mate. Wait a minute here. In the general election, are promoting a bill in the Senate Thursday that calls on the U.S. government agencies to report anti-Jewish activity, anti-Semitic, that fits them, the other boys too, the Islamists, more thoroughly, and for the State Department, wait a minute. To share more widely any new information on how the U.S. and Europe are addressing the needs of the continent's Jewish community. Since when is that their business? I'm alarmed by the steady increase in anti-Jewism we're witnessing in America and Europe. We must be vigilant in reporting any incidents of anti-Semitism to ensure the safety, security, and inalienable rights of Jewish communities, unquote, Kaine said in a statement. That's not your job, you bastard. This legislation will help the State Department and Europeans work together to combat anti-Jewism and protect religious freedom for Jews and society at large, unquote. It is some of the first legislative activity in the latest phase of their Senate careers. Rubio was just re-elected to the Senate, and Kaine just indicated Thursday that he plans to run for re-election and not try to leave the body for a 2020 presidential campaign. Very interesting. Jews are leaving places like France in record numbers and landing in places such as Israel. Well, isn't that where they wanted to go? In part due to recent attacks on Jewish sites in countries like Belgium and Denmark. Fears of anti-Judaism have also spiked in the U.S. during the 2016 campaign and Trump's election. A number of journalists have reported receiving anti-Jewish tweets and mailings from Trump supporters, and some Jewish groups have been dismayed by the elevation of Steve Bannon, a top Trump aide who is allied with the alt-right movement. And, you know, it's interesting, it's sort of funny how they accuse Breitbart News of being so racist and anti-Semitic. It's not. These guys that are saying all that stuff either have not tuned into it, or they're just plain lying, because you can't get on there and talk about Jews in a negative light. You can't get on there and talk about blacks in a negative light. And so most of this nonsense is just nonsense. Funny. About every 5 minutes, Breitbart News is saying how we hate racists, and we hate anybody that runs around with them, and we hate their mother, their father, and even their dogs. They do that all the time. And these people say they're anti-Jew and anti-Semitic and anti-black and Mexican. Somebody's conning somebody here. Well, here's some interesting stuff out of an article I drug out. John McCain indulged racial fears and Mitt Romney played on racial resentment, but they refused to go further. They just used it. To borrow from George Wallace, they refused to cry nigger. This is important. By rejecting the politics of explicit racism and white backlash, they moved the political battleground to a nominally colorblind concerns. Race was still a part of these clashes. It's unavoidable. But neither liberals nor conservatives would litigate the idea of a pluralistic, multiracial democracy. Looking back, I thought this meant that we had a consensus. It appears instead we had a detente, and Trump shattered it. Now we go on to the structure of American racial detente. The rules of the deal were pretty straightforward. For whites, they stated that outright racist statements and explicit appeals to white racial identity were essentially banned. Along with this, whites accepted a double standard about the appropriateness of cultural and political tribalism. For obvious and reasonable historical and economic reasons, black and brown people explicitly pursued their own interests was viewed differently than whites doing the same thing. That's for sure. The other side of the deal was that so long as white people were sufficiently punished for acts of outright racism, minority leaders and communities would be cautious with accusations of racism. The key here was that once leveled and proved, the accusation of racism was a blow most whites could not come back from. From Jimmy the Greek to Michael Richardson, being labeled a racist was a black mark that did not wash off easily. This was the basic argument that set our cultural norms, a set of rules with relatively clear boundaries. Under those rules, many of Trump's words and actions would have been immediately disqualifying, but they weren't, because the rules are no longer in effect. The clearest example of Judge Gonzalo Curiel drama by the rules of detente, saying the judge cannot fulfill his duties because of his race or nationality, counted as a firing offense. Indeed, leaders of both left and right assumed Trump could not overcome it. But not only did many white voters break the rule of disqualifying a person based on a racist statement, they broke the second rule too. They began to ask why Trump couldn't say a Mexican judge might be unfair, when we hear all the time about the danger of all white juries and white police officers. The white acceptance of legitimate racial double standards had dissipated, and without it, detente could not stand. There is a misconception that political correctness was responsible for the breakdown of the racial detente. This is incorrect. Political correctness, as loose a term as it is, was the means by which we continually renegotiate the terms of the deal. After all, the primary rules for whites had exactly to do with what was acceptable to say. Privilege theory and concept of systematic racism dealt a death blow to the detente. In embracing these theories, minorities and progressives broke their essential rule, which was not to run around calling everyone a racist. As these theories took hold, every white person became a racist who must confess that racism and activity makes amends. Yet if the white woman who teaches gender studies at a Bernard with the Ben Shahn drawings in her office is a racist, what chance do the rest have? Within a few years, a privilege theory took hold. Many whites began to think that no matter what they did, they would be called racist, because in fact, that was happening. Previously, there were rules. They shifted at times, but it adhered to they largely protected one from the charge of racism. It's like the Morrissey lyric, quote, "Is evil just something you are or something you do?" unquote. Under the detente, racism was something you did. Under privilege theory, it's something you are. That shift from carefully directed accusations of racism for the direct actions to more general charges of unconscious racism took away the carrot for the whites. Worse, it led to defensiveness and the feeling of victimization that make today's whites in many ways much more tribal than they were 30 years ago. White people are constantly told to examine their whiteness, not to think of themselves as racially neutral, that they did, but the result was not introspection that led to reconciliation. It was a decision that white people have just as much right to think of themselves as special interest groups as anyone else. The supposedly unfortunate place where we find ourselves now, in one which blatantly attacks on white people, often from white people, are driving them further into a tribal cocoon. Samantha Bee's awful and irresponsible berating of white women as the evil force behind Trump's victory, while condescendingly describing a magic people of color as the ones who can save us, is a clear example of where white defensiveness and victimization are coming from. Furthermore, the ever-present drumbeat from the left that every conservative victory is the death throes of bad old white people who are about to be swept away by waves of brown immigration is making many whites dig in. On a certain level, how can you blame them? They are explicitly being told that their values and way of life are under the sword. How do we expect them to react? The detente was far from perfect. It often allowed quieter racism to lurk unchallenged. In some ways, it was a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. But Band-Aids have a role of play in treating bullet wounds. Their body heals itself better when the wound is clean and free from infection. This is true of discourse's ability to heal our body politic as well. Under the detente, there was still racism, but Steve Bannon, whose publication Breitbart has traded in vile explicit racism, and that's bullshit, could never have been considered for White House chief of staff. You know, I listen to a little of that Breitbart every morning, and I don't hear all the shit they're talking about. All due respect, whether the old detente was better or worse than the current conditions is probably a purely academic question. It is not coming back. It was created in a cauldron of very specific historical moment. Its creators had known and experienced racism in ways we simply have not. And they were more willing to compromise to keep the monster at bay while hopefully new generations naturally became more racially accepting. Through the schools and everything, movies, you name it, books. Cultural and political white tribalism, I love that term, in its current form is likely here to stay for some time. Perhaps the best we can do now is forge our own new agreement. We are very far from achieving that, but we can all take a concrete step towards the goal. We can listen to each other without immediate judgment and with trust in people's good faith. That trust will not always be rewarded, but without it, a detente can never be. If generations of Americans who lived through the racism, riots, anguish, and terror of the civil rights struggle were able to trust each other's decency and create cultural codes and norms to punish abject racism, we should be able to do it too. But the truly scary thing is that at this moment, it doesn't appear we want to. Boys and girls, you know that the black race and the Hispanic, or not Hispanic, but mestizos, are not going to turn around and go the other way. The more that the whites resist, the more violent they're going to get, which technically, as far as I'm concerned, is good. So we'll see how it goes. But this is a positive, very positive article as far as I'm concerned. That's it for today. I'll be back Monday, Moon's Day. And in the meantime, I have nothing to say to you federales or locals or anybody else.
Mister. I might even
Baker. I'm the guy that used to date your little sister. I'm the resistor.
And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker.
And say it isn't what it means, but let me tell you what it means. This means war.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world.